Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. At an event in North Carolina last week, Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump did something unusual. He expressed regret.
Sometimes in the heat of debate and speaking on a multitude of issues, you don't choose the right words or you say the wrong thing. I have done that. And believe it or not, I regret it.
That statement appeared to be geared at turning the page on a campaign pockmarked from the beginning with insults used to counter the competition. Then his campaign manager, Paul Manafort, resigned. So it's time for our weekly reporters roundtable. We'll cover it all today. Joining us in the studio, Jim Siegel, State House reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome back, Jim.
Good morning.
Jackie Borchardt, State House reporter for Cleveland.com. Welcome back.
Thanks.
And Joe Ingles, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Welcome back.
Great to be here.
So now he's reshuffled again. A new head of the campaign, a new senior staff, as it were. Is a reshuffle even practical at this point, Jim Siegel?
Well, I think he had to do something. The campaign was heading in the wrong direction. The polls were heading in the wrong direction. And, yeah, I mean, it's sort of – I don't know at what point the light bulb goes off for people, but, I mean, it had to dawn on him at some point that I'm going to lose, and I'm going to lose badly if I don't start changing something. If you know, and it didn't seem like – when he was put on the teleprompter when Paul Manafort was there, you could tell it was very uncomfortable for him. I mean, he sounded better, I think, to some because of, you know, he was actually putting forth a message and he wasn't stepping all over himself with little side comments and insults. But if you watch him, he clearly wasn't very comfortable with it. Now, it seems like he's been a little more comfortable lately talking on the teleprompter because I think there's just a bit more comfort with the people who he's working with now. And frankly, Manafort had to go because he's coming under federal investigation for his ties to Ukraine. There's cash payments involved that are under the table. There's now accusations of illegal lobbying on behalf of the pro-Russian Ukraine president here in the United States. And so, I mean, you know, unless Paul Manafort is leading you to glory and victory, you know, and it is the main cog in your wheel in your machine, then you had to. I mean, he pretty much had to let him go at some point because it was just going to be a continued distraction.
You know what I was taken back by, Ann, was that if you listen to the crowd seemed to be booing him when he was doing that. It was like
in other words, don't change.
Right. And I think he's got to be – that's the problem that Trump has. His appeal is to people who like him because he is – out there with these outrageous comments, the things that are not PC. He's got that appeal to those folks. And so he's got to be really careful that he doesn't come off like the typical teleprompter politician.
But to win.
Well, right. That's the challenge is, you know, and you see this every time you have the primary and candidates move to the right and the left. Mm-hmm. And then after the primary is over, they're supposed to, you know, gravitate more to the center. And I think, you know, you really saw this in 2012 with Mitt Romney. That's been the question all along since Donald Trump locked down the primary is, OK, is he going to move to the center and win? And I think, like Jim said, I think the campaign realized, well, we got to do something because our electoral map, the path does not look good. We need to, you know, we can't win with just these supporters. But that's the challenge is how what kinds of things can he say or walk back and not lose the support of his base?
Right.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Jim Siegel.
Well, he's already walked. He's starting to look like he's walking back some of his immigration stances,
right,
which have been very, very kind of, you know, stark, I guess is one way to put it. Wanting to, the deportation of 11 million
yeah,
people and the treatment of Muslims that he's talked about and the building the wall. And it seems like he's kind of walking some of that back now. And I found it interesting, this whole thing about sometimes I say things and in the heat of the battle and I regret the, now I regret them. And again, I wish he didn't have the teleprompter on at that point, because it really would have been nice to hear him say something from the heart that he actually did regret this stuff. And I think would have been much more believable had he not doubled down and tripled down on so many of the things that he had said. Like, for example, the fight he had with that Gold Star family.
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't just say something in the heat of the moment and say, oh, you know, I probably went too far there. He said it again, and he went after him again and again, and he tweeted about it, and he went on television. And so it's, I don't know, how much are people really buying that he is regretting this? And I'll provide another example. Ted Strickland recently in his campaign said something about, you know, this was a good time for Justice Scalia to die.
Yeah.
or to go. I mean, he didn't say it exactly like that, but he basically tried to almost indicated that it was a good thing that Justice Scalia died and left an opening. And, you know, it got
yep.
deservedly so, some negative coverage. And a day or two later, he apologized and said, look, I didn't, you know, I shouldn't have said that.
It didn't come out the way I meant it.
Right. Now, that is more of a typical, I say something and I regret it later in the heat of the moment. And Donald Trump has been, I don't think this is heat of the moment. This has been very pervasive for months and months. It's more of who he is. And To me, I think it would have been more impactful had he gotten off the teleprompter and spoke a little more from the heart.
And if you go back and look at the words he said, he doesn't apologize for any specific comments. So it's kind of...
Megyn Kelly's still out there hanging on.
Right. You got Megyn Kelly, immigrants, women. I mean, all of the different people who have been offended by something
Ted
that
Cruz's
he said.
Wife,
I mean,
blah,
I guess
blah, blah.
He was trying to, you know, include... you know, Ted Cruz himself. You know, I guess if you were one of those people, maybe this would appeal to you. But it's so general, I don't know.
You know, there's another thing as far as them backtracking on the mass deportation of 11 million undocumented immigrants. That's a huge thing for his supporters.
It is.
And I would imagine, I get the feeling that people out there are going, well, wait a minute, kind of like the Bernie Sanders supporters felt when he endorsed Hillary Clinton.
Right, right. I was watching Trump's first dad the other day, and it was on immigration. He was talking about immigration.
Right.
And it was interesting because he didn't talk about the moratorium ban on, you know, people coming in that ad. He didn't talk about the wall at all. And if you go to his rallies, I mean, I have not seen or been to a rally where the crowd hasn't started chanting about the wall. I mean, that's kind of a signature issue for him.
Right.
Yeah. And so he didn't that ad was, you know, it was speaking to the security of the nation and, you know, we've got to keep our border secure and all these other things in very general terms. And that's not the way Trump speaks when he's in person and when he's talking to people. That's not the way he speaks. So it almost in some ways didn't even sound like a man.
Hmm. He's in Akron today. He's been speaking to largely white, kind of middle class Americans at this point. You know, we know that both of them, Trump and Clinton, are going to be here ad nauseum, you know, right up until November 8th. What do you think he's going to say today? What do we know about what he's going to say today? Anything? They haven't put anything out?
Not that I'm aware of, but...
No, I haven't seen anything.
I wouldn't be surprised if we heard a little bit more about immigration, just because that was brought up over the weekend in the Sunday shows. His new campaign manager was on, and that's kind of where everyone's kind of surprised about this maybe softening of the mass deportation. Mm-hmm. And I think he's scheduled to give a speech, a more detailed address on that later in the week. But I wouldn't be surprised if he did a little on that. I mean, it's... Clearly, the Trump campaign sees a way to win Ohio, and they see that through, you know, white middle class blue collar workers. They were in Youngstown earlier this month.
Yeah.
And now they're in Akron. They set up a bunch of field offices, but they're not in Hamilton County, which is you know, a pivotal county that was red but has voted for Obama now. So I don't know. I think. Maybe we'll see a softer message like we saw last week with this new campaign manager and new staff in. It's a little bit of I'll be watching to see how different it is.
Yeah, and apparently it's not a complete pivot we're going to see here, because If you just, I'm just looking at Donald Trump's Twitter feed right now.
Okay.
And 2 hours ago, there's the Morning Joe program on MSNBC. They do a ton of politics discussions in the morning, and apparently they said some things that weren't nice about Donald Trump this morning. I did not see it, but Donald Trump tweeted out 2 hours ago, "Someday when things calm down, I'll tell the real story of," and it's Joe Scarborough who's the host. "I'll tell the real story of Joe Scarborough and his very insecure longtime girlfriend, Mika," which is the co-host, "two clowns," is what he calls them. Now, again, you are running for president of the United States.
That's
you
not
just
president.
You just and went you call- on Twitter talking about a talk show host's insecure girlfriend, and he called them clowns.
Yeah, and he does this with other people. It's not just Joe Scarborough. He talks about other reporters like this. He talks about other politicians. He'll try to intimate that there's something going on that he knows about, only he knows about, but he won't tell you what it is. You know, it never comes right out and says what it is, usually. It's always just...
In other words, is this sustainable?
Right. Well, and Mika, who's the female host on the show, he then calls her... "She's off the wall, a neurotic, and not very bright."
Oh, my.
I mean, this...
That sounds like standard Trump.
And if you're wanting to get a woman's vote, I mean, that's real endearing right there, calling a woman who's on TV and doing a serious show as being not very bright. The comments he makes to NBC's Katie Tour, she's on The Detail that follows him around. He calls her little Katie. He's constantly, you know, berating her with things. People, you know, women see this.
She said she had to get Secret Service protection to leave a rally once.
Right.
Because he pointed her out and they were worried that she was going to get, like, attacked in the parking lot. They actually needed Secret Service protection for her.
And so if you're trying to appeal to women, you're kind of in a cave if you think women aren't reading this and seeing this. Because, you know, I think most women have had a situation in their life where a man has been a bully to them because they're a woman. And, you know, whether or not this is because she's a woman, I'm not even going to go there. I don't even know that that's the case. But whether or not it is... The fact is that this is the kind of behavior that is exhibited in those situations, and most women can relate to it in something in their own life. And it's not that they're big Katie Tour fans or Mika fans or whatever, but they're sitting there saying, you know what, so-and-so did that to me one time, and that doesn't feel good being on the receiving end of that.
But I think for every voter who thinks that, there's another one who sees that media report and says, oh, it's the mainstream media blowing things out of proportion. They hate Trump. The deck is stacked against him.
But aren't they already in the group that he's polling well with to begin with?
I don't know. I think that there's still some, you know, people that aren't really paying attention. I don't know if they're necessarily undecided voters. I think that's kind of a myth. But I do think a lot of people just don't pay attention. I think that's gotten a little bit better, maybe because we have social media and people are more clued in and they're able to actually follow the candidates and you see things. But
I don't know. Who does even knows who we're following anymore? Mm-hmm. I don't even know. Although with Donald Trump, you always have a lot of confidence that Twitter feed is all Donald all the time. Judy and Bexley are on the air. Hi, Judy.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
You know, I was watching the Olympics, the swimmer, what's his name, Lemke?
Lochte?
Yeah, Ryan Lochte or something.
He did everything but tell the truth. He lied. Now, that's not why I'm calling. Let's go to Donald Trump. Number one, we see the real Donald Trump. See, we have unrealistic expectations for Donald Trump. We want him to be more politically correct. That's not Donald Trump. He is a bully. Now we want, because he knows he's going to lose unless he changes, unless he mellows out, but he is still the original Donald Trump. Listen, I'm black. I have never lived in the ghetto. I'm college educated. I retired from a major corporation. I was a top salesperson for the whole state of Ohio. So when he makes these references insinuating that all black people live in the ghetto, what do you have to lose? Vote for, why?
Referring to his most recent remarks, I think just in the last couple of days, right, yeah. Judy, talking to a largely white audience as well.
About black people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, What yeah. do you think that's about?
Judy, you're speechless.
No, let me just make one other comment.
Sure.
When you see Donald Trump giving his speeches, always look to the right. What will you see? One black person. I mean, it's the truth. Donald Trump is very dangerous. He has already told you how he feels about minorities. He wants to build a wall. I mean, he wants to send all of the illegals back. To where?
Judy, thanks for your call. Take care.
I take it Judy's not voting for Donald Trump.
We will return. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The U.S. Senate and Ohio Senate race in Ohio between former Democrat Governor Ted Strickland and Republican incumbent Rob Portman has been in a virtual dead heat for months. Now Portman enjoys a 5 percentage point lead in the polls over Strickland and also a big fundraising margin of success over Portman, over Strickland, I should say. Still with us for our weekly reporters roundtable, Jim Siegel, State House reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, Jackie Borchardt, State House reporter for Columbus for Cleveland.com, and Joe Engels, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. There are still miles to go before this contest is put to rest, but a 5-point lead, I see. I know some polls have shown a 9 points ahead, and with a lot more money to spend, a lot more money in the coffers. Jackie Borchardt, I mean, what? Just stay the course at this point for Portman?
I don't think so. I think he's going to continue to be pretty aggressive, as he has been. I think he's been, you know, much more aggressive than Strickland. He's had the monetary resources to do so. If you've turned on a TV in the state of Ohio in the last 6 months, you've seen not one but multiple, you know, Portman ads. Ted Strickland just got on the air, I believe, within the last couple of weeks. So, but I think, you know, 5 points, you're still with the margin of error pretty close. The top of the ticket is kind of an unknown factor. Some people say with Trump at the top, it might help Rob Portman. Some people say it might, you know, hurt him. It's kind of unknown. And so Portman's response has been to go full steam ahead on his campaign. You saw Governor John Kasich campaign with him last week. And, you know, that's a little interesting because Kasich has said he's not supporting Donald Trump yet or at this point, and instead is helping all these different candidates. And Portman was asked, you know, would you rather have Kasich or Trump, something along those lines, campaign with you? And he said, no, I think, you know, John Kasich is a great surrogate for me in this state, and there's no one else I'd rather have, you know, helping me on my campaign. And so I think we'll continue to see more. I don't know if we'll see, like, Portman and Trump appearing at these rallies. He hasn't so far. They haven't together so far in Ohio. So I know, I think it's still full steam ahead. I don't think that's 5 points is comfortable for the Portman campaign. The Strickland campaign, of course, you know, it's trying to try and play a little catch up here.
You know, one of the things that Rob Portman, all this, there's $36 million of dark money that's come in and put up ads against Ted Strickland. And they keep hammering home some very basic things. You know, the 89 cents in the rainy day fund, the 350,000 jobs lost under the Strickland administration, the raising taxes. And the thing that the Strickland campaign really has to figure out how to do is to strike back on these things, because we all know from reporting it, well, that 89 cents in the rainy day fund, there's a little more to it than that. You know, there's a little more to everything than that. And they need to figure out how to explain this national recession, the fact that decisions were made to put the, what was it, $6-8 billion, whatever we got from the feds, that went pretty much right back into state government, keeping jobs afloat so that we didn't get into such a deficit as some other states did. And Ohio really rebounded much faster than some other states. And a lot of people said it was due to some of the decisions that Governor Strickland made. However, his campaign has not been able, either for lack of money or lack of something, they haven't gotten that message out there in those 30-second ads.
Well, it's there's lack of money is one thing, but you also don't have Strickland showing up on the campaign trail very much.
Well, I think he is. I mean, I've covered him quite a few times. I think he is out there. He is talking. I just covered him last week. He is out there. I think the problem is that, you know, right now these ads are just that's what everyone's seeing. That's what's, you know, huge.
Yeah.
Yeah. And a lot of what Strickland seems to be trying to do is he's attacking Portman, which is fine. However, Ted Strickland has a giant record that Rob Portman is exploiting right now. And you have to talk about that. You have got to punch back on in defense of yourself.
So why do you think they're not?
I have no idea. I can't tell you why. And they, you know, I mean, like Joe said, I completely agree with her. She, you know, there's a lot more to some of the attacks that are being levied against
Darryl him. Darryl Roland, you know, public affairs editor, referred to it in the Sunday column.
Right. So it's just, yeah, I mean, there's things he could be saying and doing, perhaps, but right now it's, you know, Portman is landing a lot of blows and right now it's effective.
Yeah. And Jackie Borchardt, does anyone ask the campaign, why aren't you guys hitting back harder?
Well, I think we talked about earlier, I think the money, the fundraising and lack of resources, where they're hitting on this, like Joe said, it's the dark money. It's the groups that are not officially, you know, working with the candidate, they can't.
But when you cover him out on the hustings, out on the stump, you know, is he talking about his successes and you know, his record?
Yeah. No, I he is. But,
doesn't
you know,
matter
I don't think that's a big it's been a lot. And I personally, I hardly ever watch TV. And I think I've seen every ad that, you know, pro Portman, anti Strickland ad that's been on.
Yeah.
On TV. And that's really hard to combat. And, you know, Ohio used to have a law that said that you had to be truthful in your political ads, which is kind of funny on its face. But that's no longer the case. So and we saw this in the last election cycle, or last year, I should say, in that election, there were some issues that came up with some political ads where that weren't totally truthful, or there's no recourse. There's no the only way to do that.
Accountability.
Right. The accountability is gone as far as like a, you know, an independent panel looking at it, an ethics panel. But now it's up to the candidate, the campaign, to get the message out for the media to sort through these ads and tell people, you know, what's what. But even then, it's already out there. And it's kind of, you know, it's a genie in the bottle thing. It's a little bit harder to counteract it.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporters roundtable. If you have a question, you have a comment, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. And any more thoughts on that?
You know, I think it was curious when Hillary Clinton was in Columbus, 3 weeks ago on a Sunday? I don't know. Anyway, Ted Strickland was there, but he wasn't on stage with her. Mm-hmm. And I found that kind of curious because he supports her. He's always supported her.
Well, also, the U.S. Senate's so important to the Democrats, and it's curious to me that he's not getting more funding, particularly since it's so close. Yeah. I mean, if Portman was ahead by 12 or 13 percentage points throughout or something like that, maybe. But what do you make of that, Jim Siegel?
Well, one of the issues is there's just so many Senate races up that the Democrats think they can take right now. And to be honest, they don't need to win Ohio. They don't need to knock off Rob Portman to take the Senate back. They've got other options.
Okay.
And so, you know, that could be part of it. They could just be looking at the landscape and deciding that they have better chances in other places. I mean, Ted Strickland did not get off to a blaze of glory with his fundraising. He had to fight through a primary that wasn't particularly contentious, but you know, he didn't. It's not like he used that. He didn't seem to build up any momentum and carry that you know, through the primary and into the general. In fact, once the general started, that's when his poll numbers started to go down. Mm-hmm. And so I think that just could be part of it, is that some of these outside groups are going to divert money to, you know, defeating other Republicans that they think are more vulnerable.
And to be fair, I think he did speak at the Youngstown stop the night before.
Oh, did he?
And I wonder if maybe he was supposed to speak and they decided not to because it was so hot.
But, it was hot.
Oh, it but was hot. He has been on the trail with Clinton, and Portman has not with Trump. And you do see a lot of that from Strickland's campaign, is pushing the relationship between Portman and Trump. And, you know, will he appear with him? He didn't appear with him. You know, they're really trying hard to pin Portman to Trump.
And right now, Portman's overperforming Trump in Ohio by 8 to 10 points. So that doesn't exactly, you know, say that, scream out to the Portman campaign that you need to go start joining Trump on the campaign trail. I think mm-hmm. he's stayed away from him so far. He generally stayed away from the Republican National Convention. And I think, you know, and now he's up anywhere 5 to 8 points. And I would be very surprised if he suddenly started appearing at Trump rallies.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that's being floated out there by the Portman campaign and every chance they get is this so-called lack of energy by Ted Strickland. And, you know, they'll say, well, you know, Portman's out there doing Pelotonia. He's out there doing, you know, building a habitat house. He's doing all these active things. Where's Ted Strickland? He seems to have a lack of energy. Well, Ted Strickland has, you know, if you follow his career, I don't ever remember him doing anything physical like Pelotonia or, you know, but he does other things. He does a lot of other things that could play well with an audience. And there again, that is not getting out there. And the Democrats are not helping him. You know, what could be perceived as a lack of energy is also, it could be played as, you know, hey, he's busy doing some serious, substantive stuff here. Look what he's doing.
Yeah. Ryan in Pickerington, you're on the air. Hi, Ryan.
Good morning. And I apologize if this has been asked and answered. There's an ad that's been in high circulation that discusses the depletion of the rainy day fund. Mm-hmm. And I was curious if you could speak to sort of, is that real and is there more to that story? Mm-hmm. It's, well, as an independent, it's sort of like, wow, that's pretty damning evidence, but maybe there's a lot more to the story than is being shared. Certainly by the Portland.
Well, campaign. Yeah, I mean, and that does go right to the issue of things are complicated and there is a lot more. Jim Siegel?
Well, the answer is it is real and it is much more complicated than what is being portrayed.
It is a rainy day fund, the ergo.
Right. It's a rainy day fund that you are to use when, you know, it's raining, which
when things are bad.
In 2008.
You know, Ohio, like everyone else, went through the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression. And when that happened, state revenues took an unprecedented nosedive. 14% 1 year, 6% another year. Mm-hmm. That never, ever has happened.
Right.
And so he, you know, Governor Strickland had to fill a massive budget hole in the middle of the budget. This was not at the start of a budget. This was in the middle of a 2-year budget that was already passed and approved by Republican legislators that, you know, he had to work and get that balance because you have to have it balanced. So, yes.
Because in Ohio, it's required by law.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. Right. So, yes, he drained the rainy day fund in order to help do that. You can now, you know, there's lots of policy arguments you can make about whether or not you agree with the way he approached things. But that rainy day fund is there for that purpose. That's what he used it for. And by the time his final budget was finished, 6 months after he left office, that rainy day fund had started to be replenished by, I think it was upwards of
$250 million.
Yeah, yeah. $250 million. So it was the uptick had already began by the time Ted Strickland left office.
Yeah, he kind of greased the skids for Governor Kasich. If you look at the numbers, just go in and look at the numbers and look at the figures behind what's being said. He greased the skids for Governor Kasich because he did protect the jobs he could protect. He did, with all that stimulus money, he made some decisions that really kept a cushion there for Ohio. And so when things started to rebound nationally, Ohio started to see those jobs come back. They started to see some of these things happen. And it was at the end of Governor Strickland's term in office and the very beginning of Governor Kasich's time in office before Governor Kasich had time to implement his own ideas and programs. So, I mean, but you don't hear that from the Strickland campaign. So I'm not sure why they're not telling that story more accurately.
Ryan, thanks a lot for your call. Ryan's call exemplifies, however, the confusion over the legacy of Strickland as Ohio governor. Thanks a lot. 614-292-8513. If you have a question or comment about what's going on in the U.S. Senate campaign in Ohio, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're right. I think someone said made the salient point. 5 percentage points isn't all that great. It's within the, still within the margin of error. So it's still a close race. There's still more to be done. But Strickland is not doing much better with fundraising either. And that's been brought up as well. It's still a big problem. Things are going to get, the airways are going to get cluttered. They're not already.
Yeah, and I don't know. I'm not sure why he's not fundraising better. I don't know, getting more funds. I'm not sure.
Well, why don't we take a break now? We will return with our reporters roundtable. With me, just heard from Joe Engels, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, Jim Siegel, State House reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, and Jackie Borchardt of the Ohio Public. I'm sorry, of
Cleveland.com.
So give us a call, 614-292-8513, if you want to participate. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. In just about 2 weeks, Ohio's new medical marijuana law goes into effect. That is, if it can get off the ground. The state plans to spend about $1.8 million, at least that's what has been requested, to set up the regulatory system for medical pot. But an Ohio Supreme Court advisory opinion issued earlier this month has warned lawyers who represent marijuana businesses that they risk ethics violations. Still with us for our weekly reporters roundtable, Jim Siegel, State House reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, Joe Engels, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, and Jackie Borchardt of Cleveland.com. Jackie, will everything be ready to go on September 8th on the kickoff day?
Well, no. Everything ready to go. There's a lot that needs to happen for this, people hear medical marijuana law passed. They think, oh, I'll be able to, go into a dispensary and buy marijuana on September 8th. That's not happening. Mm-hmm. That's not happening for at least a year, two max, maybe even longer. So what happens on September 8th is the law takes effect. The importance of that date for patients who would be treated, be part of the program, is that you can have an affirmative defense against prosecution for a marijuana crime.
If you're busted for having pot.
Right. But there's some qualifiers there. You have to have one of the conditions. You have to have a doctor's note saying that you have one of the conditions. And then you also have to have forms that would be acceptable under the law. So you couldn't have like a pipe if you were, caught. I don't know. I've talked to law enforcement officials, though, who have said they're not going to be looking to bust people. So it's more of a peace of mind thing for some really ill patients.
What's the ethics issue that the Supreme Court raised? Has this been raised in other states?
Yes, it has been raised in other states. So essentially, the law includes a provision that says professional license holders, which would include attorneys, are protected from discipline if they're working in the marijuana industry, if they're helping with businesses or whatever. But the problem there is that Ohio attorneys follow the ethical standards that are set by a professional board under the Supreme Court. And there's a rule there that says, you can't aid and abet a crime. That would be, improper for an attorney. And the opinion came down that even though it's legal in Ohio and we have a state law, which you would want attorneys to help you advise you on, it's still illegal federally. And so by helping someone set up a dispensary, you would be aiding a federal crime and could be found.
But if you have you're representing somebody who's been busted for pot and they have the affirmative defense of qualifying for one of these 20 or 18 or 20 reasons for getting a prescription of marijuana, would you be aiding and abetting them?
It's unknown. I mean, I think so. In this advisory opinion, it's a non-binding opinion. Mm-hmm. It's the first time that the court has actually looked at this in an official capacity. Several times, the opinion, they hinted that the court needs to look at this more, that other states have run into this issue and they've either changed their rules or, looked at it and made some amendments to their process to allow attorneys to work in this space. Because it's just ludicrous. It has a really chilling effect. Think about it. If you're setting up a business, you get an attorney to help you, negotiate contracts for your lease or for your land that you're buying, right, apply as a register as
insurance,
a business for insurance.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many, this is really should be a boon for attorneys, this whole setup. But so anyway, the Supreme Court last week, Chief Justice Maureen O'Connor said that the court is going to revise this rule. And she acknowledged that other states have done similar things. So I expect them to modify the services that will be provided. What that looks like is unknown. Mm-hmm. If they take a really narrow path and just say, look, they can help with, all the same services they would apply to, any other small business, or, what they decide to do. But they are going to look at it. And, really nothing is going to get off the ground for another year or so. So, being done before September 8th is not crucial, but, it could happen.
And, you just mentioned, Anne, a prescription. The doctors cannot prescribe.
That's right. They can only recommend
marijuana.
Or something, refer.
They can give a recommendation,
right,
for it.
That's
another,
right,
little problem here. There's different schedules of drugs, okay? Federally, they set drugs at different levels. And it's some drugs are a higher level and have more controls than the lower level drugs. Marijuana is in with heroin and some of the highest controlled drugs. And the federal government had the opportunity to downgrade that from a Schedule 1 into something, less restrictive. And they could have done that. But a couple weeks ago, they decided not to, and they left it at a federal one or Schedule 1. And I know Ohio lawmakers, when I was covering the medical marijuana debate, they've been telling me that they really would like the federal government to take that out of Schedule 1 because it makes this much easier for them to implement if it's not that highly controlled substance. So that didn't happen. And I think that's in and of itself causing a little bit of this problem because of the way that the federal government,
right,
looks at the issue.
But that's not new.
Nothing changed. So the announcement 2 weeks ago that the DEA was not going to reschedule it was kind of status quo. They did open up the growing of marijuana for approved research, which so far has only been done at one institution, the mm-hmm. University of Mississippi. Now they've said they're going to open that up to other institutions. And that was one roadblock to getting some of this research done. But otherwise, everything else, is in place. And the DEA made it very clear that they were acting on the recommendation from the Food and Drug Administration, which had recommended against it. And that's because marijuana is a plant. And the FDA does not approve plants for medical purposes. They will approve things that are taken from plants and put into, a pill or a liquid or some other form, but they're not going to approve a whole plant as medicine.
Speaking of ethics issues, a coalition has formed to urge the removal of a member of the state medical board. Actually, the board president, Michael Gonadakis, saying that his other job as president of Ohio Right to Life poses a conflict of interest, as they put it, so profound that it cannot be remedied. The letter is dated from last week, from August 19th. They provided documentation, they said, that shows that Michael Gonadakis and Ohio Right to Life publicly condemned three abortion providers who are named in a complaint that the Dayton Right to Life filed with the medical board. The complaint is pending. He hasn't recused himself. Has this been a conflict from the outset, Joe Ingles? What do we know about it?
Yeah, you know, when he was first named to the medical board, a lot of abortion rights advocates said, hey, this is really not good. You shouldn't have someone who's this heavily involved with lobbying the state on legislative issues. They should not be sitting on the medical board making decisions on that end of the spectrum. But, you know, the thing is, I think Ohio Right to Life is one of the most effective at getting their legislation through. I mean, when they come out and they want something, chances are if they back it and they put some elbow grease into it, it usually passes with this Republican legislature. And I think that's part of the situation there. That's why this coalition is really concerned, because they feel like Ohio Right to Life has come out against some things that have been deemed unconstitutional by a court, at least at some level, maybe appealed and they're okay. But, you know, there's been a lot of court battles in the past couple of years over some of the issues that have been passed by the state legislature. And I think that's some of the frustration that's named in that complaint.
This just came out this morning. This press release just came out this morning. How do you expect the Kasich administration to respond? Michael Ganadakis was appointed by the governor to represent consumers on the state medical board. How do you expect him to respond, Jim Siegel?
I really have no idea, but it is. I mean, they do raise a valid issue. The Ohio Right to Life's Dayton affiliate has filed a complaint with the medical board regarding at least one doctor, maybe more. Actually, three doctors up in that area, accusing them of violating the law because of an abortion performed on someone who was basically under the influence of drugs, and you know that. And then there was a press release put out by Ohio Right to Life. It quoted the Ohio Right to Life's executive director, Devin Scribner, and you know. Basically, they're saying, look, you know, you can't be president of Ohio Right to Life and then basically have your organization filing complaints against doctors while you sit on the as president of the state medical board. And that's they saying that's an inherent conflict of interest. I will be interested to see if there's, you know, what the reaction is to that, because it's on its face, it does sound like there could be some concern there. And it's not just about it being an abortion issue. It's if, you know, anybody who's sitting on a board where there's a pending case in front of it that deals directly with something that happens in your other life outside of that board.
The Progress Ohio, which issued this press release, I believe, also filed a formal complaint with the Ohio Ethics Commission that provides additional evidence of conflicts, including an article in the Toledo Blade in April, or in April 2013, when Michael Ganadakis spoke out against providing medical students with instruction on how to perform an abortion. Is this going to go away? I mean, what do you think, Jackie Borchardt?
Is the complaint going to go away?
Well, yeah.
I don't think so. I think they have to answer to the complaint. I mean, the Ethics Commission, though, does not release
what
the
it's
findings,
doing, right?
So only afterward, and if there's something. So I don't know. And I, to be honest, I haven't looked at it. But, you know, this is, like Jim said, this is not a new thing. Ever since he was appointed, when he was appointed, you know, pro-choice supporters, you know, condemned that decision and said that, you know, he shouldn't be in that position. I mean, the way the board is, he wasn't unqualified to be appointed to the board. He met the qualifications to fill a spot on the board. That's the way the state law says that boards are to be filled. So,
meaning he was just a, what were the qualifications? Not,
well,
no,
I believe the board has to have like a certain membership be physicians, and certain members are public, you know, appointed public people that don't necessarily need to have qualifications, and there are doctors on that board. Mm-hmm. And then him becoming president, I think, is only in the last year or so. And I believe that's not a requirement to be president of the board. I don't think you have to be a physician, technically.
He's a lawyer.
Right. Mm-hmm. So I'll be interested to see where the complaint goes and the evidence that they've had. Like you said, in 2013, this has been something that's been building for a while. And I think the key point in this is what Jim had just said, that, you know, some of these things are being filed against doctors. Well, that's an actual task that the medical board oversees. And that maybe is why we're seeing the complaint now as opposed to, you know, in the past.
Okay. I wanted to talk about Head Start funding. Jim, you wrote about how a new state plan would change how Ohio pays for child care and early learning. What's the impact on Head Start? What are we talking about here?
Well, it's an issue about layering of state and federal funds, using them at the same time. There's apparently a number of Head Start centers have been, this is common across the country, they'll take the federal Head Start money and then they'll use state child care dollars and sort of stack them up together and say, okay, we're going to provide this child a wider range of services than maybe we could provide if we just use federal money and then use that state money for, say, an extra 3 hours of childcare after the Head Start program was finished for the day. And so the apparently Department of Job and Family Services did some checking here recently and discovered that this was going on. And somebody, although apparently it's been going on for years now, but apparently somebody just it dawned on them that, you know what, Ohio doesn't allow that. Ohio doesn't say, you know, there's nothing in Ohio that says you're allowed to use federal and state money together. So they're basically telling folks you can't do that anymore. You have to you can use your federal Head Start money, but you know the state money has to go toward other things. And you know I can't speak to all the nitty-gritty details of it, but I know there's concerns that some, you know, that maybe some services will have to be diminished, some quality of these preschool programs will go down. And this has caught the attention of legislators in both parties. There's concern being raised by both Democrats and Republicans right now about this, and maybe that something needs to change in the law to allow this to continue. But there's also folks looking at it saying, look, there's just way too much money going into some of these programs when you stack up this money this way, and that if we took it out and spread it around a little more, the state child care money, maybe we could help more kids. The argument against that, of course, is that the kids it's helping now are it's being concentrated right now in the areas where they have the most need, and these kids are really there's a lot of struggle to get them so that they're not entering kindergarten and first grade way behind their peers.
Is this a prohibition in state law or something that's just not permitted by state law? There's a distinction there. Are they working through that,
I think there's basically two ways. The law either allows you to do it one way or another. You can either be a layering state, or you can be I forget the name of the other one, but it's a compound, whatever. It's one that lets you layer, one that doesn't, and we're considered the one that doesn't. And so, I mean, I honestly I've not read the exact statute in the law, but that's JFS has decided that this is, you know, this is not permitted, and they're asking folks to change. And it's about $12 million, but it's also tens of millions more in federal money that folks say they could lose, federal matching dollars.
Right. If they don't have the state.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
And the Head Start people say that this money will go other places. Other states will benefit from this money if Ohio doesn't pull it down. And that, you know, we send our taxes to Washington. Why should other states be getting this money when we should be getting our share of it to help our kids?
Mm-hmm.
That's what they would say.
There's a cross here. I mean, there's cross purposes then what we're talking about here. If they don't use the state money to pull down the federal money, then
where do they get it?
There's some federal funding and some of that is matching the state funding.
Okay.
So the actual impact of taking if you had to choose one or the other, it's like, well, how do you choose? And the number of the federal dollars are going to go down even more if you, you know, go with them instead of the state, if you were to do it that way.
Gotcha. Okay.
But a lot of these programs, they've used that money not only in extending hours, but in hiring better educators.
Right.
And that's kind of the issue because it's people. It's not necessarily, you know, sending kids home early or closing down early. It's actually people that you've invested money in.
Yeah, gotcha. Democratic senator or Democratic representative, I'm sorry, they change places a lot. But Democratic Representative Teresa Federer has spoken out about this. And she says that she's from the Toledo area. She says some of the Start child care centers up there have actually gone out and hired 4-year teachers for preschool, which normally teachers, you know, a lot of teachers are not 4-year teachers.
Right.
But they've hired 4-year teachers to get that quality so that they can help that population of kids that really need it the most.
Joe Ingles, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Joe Ingles, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau's Jim Siegel, thanks to you as well.
Always a good time.
Jim Siegel, State House reporter for Columbus Dispatch, and Jackie Borchardt, State House reporter for Cleveland.com, thanks to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.